This afternoon, we're going to be focusing on the question of seeking marriage. First of all, unless you are in love with God, you are not ready to seek marriage. And this means surrender to God's will, His way, not yours, and make that surrender an aspect of all areas of life. And that means be willing to abandon legitimate activities that reduce your delight in God. For example, playing the piano, fishing, and ping pong can all be used appropriately as you relate to other people and bless them. But if they become a passion and consume your thoughts, you need to make changes. The result is that you have time to develop personal, godly, spiritual depth. And so you need to view life as an investment. Investments always mean short-term sacrifice for long-term gain. And that enables you to focus on eternal values. Remember that marriage is for life, no divorce and remarriage. And so pray. Ask God to bring people together in His timing. Ask God for wisdom and insight. And pray individually and with your parents. Actively work with your parents in this pursuit. And as you do so, think of development of character. A young man should think, what kind of husband a godly and wise lady would want? And then he should develop his character into that kind of man. And similarly, for a young woman, what kind of wife would a godly and wise man want? Then develop your character into that kind of woman. So, what about development of gifts? I believe that people should prepare for life before marriage and avoid the disappointment of maturing in opposite directions after marriage. I know of a young woman who grew up in France where her parents served as missionaries, and thus she was naturally prepared as missionary to France. She planned to go serve there. She got married. Her husband decided after some seminary training that missionary service in France was not for him, and this was a tremendous disappointment to this young woman. The contrast is a person named Mary Slessor of Calabar. She lived in an earlier era. She was ready to forego marriage if God had a higher job, and she actually broke her engagement because her fiancé did not share her vision for God's calling. And God used that woman mightily to bring an end to many evil practices in Nigeria. Consider the question of marriage in relation to life. How does marriage fit into and enhance the calling of God? And secondly, will there be a mutual spiritual benefit? If you're considering how marriage can enhance your life, you've got to be thinking, how can marriage enhance the other person's life? What we need is to have an unswerving commitment to please God. In any area of life, the greater the potential for good, the greater the potential for disaster. Godly marriage is so wonderful, but ungodly unions can be so terrible. And Satan often brings his choice first, always compromising some principle of God. And God is waiting with what is best, seeing if you will follow Him with your whole heart. You see that pattern happen various times. Satan wants to destroy you. He's a liar and a murderer. And he especially wants marriage to destroy you. He wants to use something that God has ordained as very good and twist it to your destruction. He invites you to be involved sexually before marriage. He invites you to rush into marriage a bad choice. Oh, that person would be good. Pick that one. When it's really a very bad choice. And then after marriage, Satan tempts you to descend into bitterness and strife and violate God's commands for marriage, love, leadership, and submission, and forsake your spouse for somebody else. Even many churches permit remarriage after divorce. A godly approach in this whole thing of seeking marriage is parental guidance and fellowship. Now, there's some cautions I would offer to parents. Beware of ever teasing single persons about romance. Acquaintances you have, and if your children hear that, then they may feel reluctant to talk to you about some of the aspirations they have and thoughts they have. So instead, encourage children to be in their present special ministry of singlehood. Don't be a stumbling block. And then also, as parents, Don't just turn your child loose to find somebody you hope you'll approve of. In other words, you want to help them engage righteous thinking in this process. So teach your children proper expectations for marriage. Marriage is more than a practical arrangement. The West African Fulani tribe, marriage is an arrangement. She needs someone to herd the cattle and make the decisions, and he needs someone to cook his food and bear the children. But as godly people, we want more than a congenial existence. We want to find spiritual fellowship, so we want both devoted to Christ and not be divided on what church to attend. That can cause many marriage conflicts. But more than that, we want more than spiritual fellowship. We want fellowship of life. I know of a prominent teacher who taught, "We don't marry whom we love whom we marry." Now that is very confusing emphasis, and it produces a false aura of spirituality. The wisdom approach is this: attraction. Do I like this person? I'm looking for more than a godly person. Yes, absolutely, you look for a godly person. But look for someone you really like to be with. Look for somebody who's interesting. Now I want to tell you the difference between character and personality. Character is like the seal on a jar of canned goods. Personality is like the contents of the jar. So suppose you have two choices for the contents of a jar: cherries or pickles. The seal is critically important. It keeps whatever is in there from rotting. But when you're taking something out to eat, which would you rather have, cherries or pickles? When you're thinking of marriage, choose the kind of person that you will enjoy loving and enjoy being with. Before marriage, we choose someone we would enjoy loving, and after marriage, we have already decided to love this one. So consider your goals in life and how those goals can be enhanced by marriage. Will your spouse need all kinds of American contraptions and equipment and foods in order to be happy on the mission field? If that's the case, you're going to have difficulty. A missionary partner needs stamina and flexibility and to understand sacrifice as a privilege. So what is a wise procedure for courtship? I believe it's wise to teach your daughter that if any young man asks for a date, he must ask her father first. This greatly simplifies her life. If she's not interested, she can tell her father the answer is no. And then if the suitor comes back again, she can say, "Did you ask my father?" "Well, yes." "What did he say?" "Well, he said no." Well, then that door is still shut. Simplifies her life. It also protects her from bad mistakes. The father has invested 20 years in his daughter, and he wants to be careful what happens to the investment. And so the father can send away unworthy suitors. He can ask important questions that would be awkward or inappropriate for the girl to ask. For example, a young man came asking about one of my daughters, and I said to him, "What is your devotional life like? What has the Lord taught you in your devotions?" Well, he admitted he doesn't have them very often. I said, "What about sexual purity?" Well, he admitted he'd been looking at some things he shouldn't. I told him, "You are not ready to form a relationship with any girl until you get these two things straightened out." Those kind of questions would be difficult for a girl to be asking a young man. The father needs to ask that kind of question. So you interview the man who desires your daughter, put him at ease, tell him you're honored that he's come to ask, and tell him that you want to understand how he thinks, what his goals are for marriage, how he expects to achieve those goals. So you can ask him about his moral purity. Are you a virgin? If the answer is no, I suggest that the interview is finished. Why? Because would it be the best choice for your virgin daughter to have him as a husband? What's the answer? Is that a best choice? No, it's not the best choice. And then tell him that answer immediately. If he is a virgin, continue. Do you look at pornography? If so, he needs to have a consistent victory in that area before he seeks to have a relationship with any woman. Find out about his personal relationship with God. You can give your testimony. Now, if he doesn't quite know what to say when you say give your testimony, you can ask him some questions. Well, you can say, "Well, when were you converted? And what were the circumstances? And what changes did it make in your life?" You can ask him, what is your devotional life like? If he doesn't know what to say, you could say, well, tell me some insight the Lord has shown you recently. Tell me about sharing your faith with someone else. Find out about his beliefs. Is Christ sufficient to provide victory over sin? Is the Bible accurate in everything it says? Eternal security. Is it possible to forfeit your salvation? Why or why not? What about remarriage? Is that possible only if your first spouse dies? Or are there exceptions? What do you believe about the Christian woman's covering? What do you believe about non-resistance? What do you believe about Christ's return? These kind of questions are important questions to ask to understand how does this person think? Because after all, you're going to turn your daughter over to this guy and he's going to be the leader for your daughter. Learn about his family life. What kind of relationship do you have with your parents? In what ways do you want to be like your parents? Maybe he will tell you what ways he doesn't want to be like his parents. What ways do you contribute to your family? Another question to ask, what do you view as your responsibilities as a husband? And again, you can ask him more detailed questions if he doesn't come forth with spontaneous answers. What about leadership in the home spiritually? How do you intend to do that? What about leadership practically? How do you think children should be trained? Is that just your wife's job, or is it your job also? What's your view of children? Do you want to delay having children for years so you can do other things first? It's an important question. Are you financially prepared to support a wife and children? You can ask him, what would your occupation be? Are you skilled enough to provide properly? Maybe he needs to get more training first. Will you expect your wife to earn some of the income to support the family? What do you want to be doing 10 years from now? Learn about his values. Why are you interested in my daughter? Why do you want to choose her above a whole bunch of other girls that you could be thinking about? In all these discussions, you are discerning what his character is like. Watch carefully for character flaws. Is he open-hearted? Is he teachable? Is he arrogant? Is he disrespectful to your concerns for your daughter? Have humility or is he cocky? Now, if the interview with Dad is positive, thank him very much and tell him you will get back to him about it and don't make him wait a long time for an answer. And so, as father and mother, you can discuss it. And if you think that's a good idea, then discuss with your daughter. Now, it may be she already knows that there's something about this guy that she is not interested in at all for other reasons. Well, you can go back and you can tell the young man that. You take the pressure off your daughter. One of the things you might do as a parent is to request insight from siblings regarding this prospect. Siblings may already know something about this guy that disqualifies him. You know, they might talk among each other to their friends and so on and know that stuff, and you just don't happen to know it. Or they might confirm, yes, this guy is really on the ball spiritually. He would make a wonderful husband. If all these things are satisfactory and you encourage godly courtship, I believe that courtship should be permitted only if both parties desire the relationship as a possible spouse. In other words, the goal is not just to have a good time, in quotes, but to carefully evaluate and be evaluated. You don't want to fool the other person into marrying you, and you don't want to be fooled. Either one of those options would be terrible and result in a disaster in marriage. So, do you want to know these things? Yes, you do. You want to know, do I want to live with this person the rest of my life? Do I want this person to be the father or mother of my children? Let me give you a personal example in relation to Rhoda and I and our discussions that we had before we were married. In our courtship, Rhoda and I did very few of the usual things other young couples did. Like, for example, eating at restaurants and having dates that cost money and having long phone conversations. It was very expensive back in those days, and we couldn't afford those things. I was serving in a voluntary service unit instead of participating in the Vietnam War, and she was teaching in Christian elementary school. So you can imagine our cash flows were very, very tight. And these circumstances actually became a blessing instead of a hindrance because they prompted us to focus on what was truly important in courtship. We spent lots of time discussing the issues of life, what we believed about the Bible, and how to apply it. Our families lived 4 hours apart, so traveling to and from parental homes gave us lots of time to discuss biblical ideas. And writing letters was another forum for important discussions of what we were encountering and how what we were encountering was shaping our way of thinking. And often in the living room, her home or mine, we talked about how we should apply what the Bible says. And we spent time in each other's homes, and that taught us about siblings. And we could see how each other interacted with siblings and how siblings interacted back. And it was an instructive window into how the other person thinks. We learned how each other's parents and grandparents made costly decisions in order to be faithful to Christ. We played games, chess, and word games such as anagrams and probe. And we did useful work when we were at the other parent's home. I constructed a closet in her dad's house, and she helped my mother do housework. We enjoyed hiking together. We did ministry together. We worked together picking vegetables for the help of a church leader. We sang four-part harmony with another couple for people in the hospital. When our son Raphael heard about how Rhoda and I spent our courtship time, he said, "It was like each of you opened up your treasure chest and let the other person look inside." You see, that's really what you want to do in courtship. You want to let that person know what you think and how you believe. And you want them to let you know those kind of things too. You want to understand what is really going on in the heart. It was very interesting to us. People would say to us, "You know what? After you get married, you're going to have some adjustments to make." After Rhoda and I got married, we wondered, what adjustments? Our new relationship was grandly better than what we had before. There was no need for long periods of separation. There was no need to say goodbye. We could be with each other day and night. I mean, it was fabulous. In fact, our earlier discussions had produced a great foundation of unity, even on significant subjects we hadn't even thought about discussing. Why? Because we had discussed the foundations and we knew how each other thought about what God says and how it should be applied. And so after marriage, we made changes together as we matured. It wasn't like we were making deals with each other. "Well, you know what? It should be your turn to change because I changed the last time to fit into what you think." We had the privilege of growing together in new dimensions as we matured more in marriage. Now, let me mention some unwise procedures for courtship. One is a focus on fun and games and eating out. Life is not made of fun and games. Life is made of hard work. And often it's boring work. It's things that just got to be done. And you do it because it's right and because it's good and because it's useful. Lack of common interests and skills will diminish fellowship. It's a setup for marriage conflicts. Traditional dating, looking for romantic pleasure rather than seeking a life companion, produces an emotional attachment, making it difficult to make a wise decision regarding who would really make a good spouse. Then on finding and building bridges, remember, in courtship, you find bridges. What are your common interests? Do you enjoy the same kind of music? Do you both have an appetite for spiritual books? If you have an appetite for spiritual books, you can share complementary insights when you have read different types of material. Rhoda and I tend to read different types of material, but then we can share insights that we've gained, and so I can get insight from things that I would not ordinarily be reading, and she can get insights from things that I read that she would not ordinarily be reading, and it's a great blessing to both of us. And in marriage, what you do is you strengthen bridges with each other. You deliberately do that. If your spouse has an interest in some subject, then you automatically cultivate an interest in that subject at some level, even if you were not previously interested. What you're doing is building more and more bridges. It's a wonderful thing. So continued investigation during a godly courtship, what both should look for. Number one, they should be a Christian with evidence of growth in the Lord. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. I knew of a young woman who dated an unbeliever, even though that unbeliever eventually became a Christian before marriage. Then after marriage, she was deeply grieved by his lack of spiritual leadership. And eventually, she became the leader instead of her husband, helped him choose an erroneous interpretation of Scripture, and she started attending a church that promoted false theology, and he finally capitulated and attended with her. So you see what happened? One progression of unequal yoke led to another and another and another and another. So you want not only a Christian, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers, but he must be a spiritual leader. And this is necessary for both father leading the family and mother leading the children. He needs to be a person who loves to learn. That is a key for a good marriage. He needs to be a good loser at games. You know, failure here shows selfishness and bad priorities. If your friend gets irritated at the loss of a game, it is a warning flag. A parent might see this more clearly than a child. I remember a proverb that I read one time. You know the wind direction by the straws, not by the telephone poles. What's that saying? If you wait until the telephone poles are bending over, you've seen lots of destruction already. If you wait until those poles move, you've seen so much destruction that you wouldn't have to. So you watch how the wind is blowing the straws. What should the young man look for? Is this woman devoted to having her husband and children be the focus of her ministry? Does she have a meek and quiet spirit? A meek and quiet spirit is very difficult to teach after marriage. Is she teachable? Does she desire to learn? I taught Rhoda games during our courtship. I taught her chess. And she didn't say, "Ha, that game is too complicated for me. I could never learn it." I taught her how to play anagrams. And at first, I won easily. Now she plays better than I do. Choose inner character, not focus on the outer and miss the blessing. 1 Peter chapter 3. Hunt for that lasting inner ornament. Does a young lady have a ministry to her own siblings? If she lacks a ministry to her own siblings, that lack will make a poor mother. If she views younger siblings as pests, she will view her own children the same way. Does she have good housewife skills? Is she able to manage things of a household? Is she orderly in domestics? Can she do cooking? Can she do sewing, making alterations? Can she keep the house clean? Can she make economical purchases? What should the girl look for? She needs to look for a spiritual leader first of all. And remember this. In marriage, whoever you marry will be your spiritual leader. It's not that he ought to be. He will be. If he is a do-nothing spiritually person, that will be the course he sets for your home. Is this the kind of spiritual leader you want in your home? Rhoda has encountered many wives over the years in our travels who are deeply frustrated by an unspiritual husband. He has minimal interest in spiritual matters. He does not have devotions with the family. The wife's spiritual nurture of children cannot nullify the fact that her husband is a life-teaching spiritual apathy. The young lady should be looking for someone it will be a delight to submit to. God's order. Christ, man, woman. A wife, according to the Bible, must submit to her husband. But she does get to choose who she will submit to. That's a very important thing to do. You want to choose someone who treats his mother and sisters with honor and respect. Someone whose calling in life matches yours. If you feel called to missions, he should too. If he went to missions, would he be needing all kinds of American contraptions to be happy there? And practical matters. Does he know how to work, how to get a job done? Is he lazy? Can he nail 5 boards together into shelves? Well, what if his father didn't teach him? He can get a book. In life, we need to learn new things, solve new problems. Does he have a marketable skill? If not, it will be difficult to support a family. And finance management. Does his father know how to manage finances? Often that's a good indicator as to whether the son will know how. Did he buy an economical vehicle or an extravagance? If he bought an extravagance, he may resent buying a new appliance to help you in the kitchen. These kind of things help you understand what kind of person you're relating to. So as a godly courtship summary, remember, priority, first of all, spiritual. Know God. If you're not in love with God, you're not ready to seek a life partner. Follow God with all your heart. And incidentally, a little warning here, if parents are not in favor, don't marry. These marriages where parents are not in favor have a predominant statistics of disaster. And we need to understand statistics. If 95% of a certain product fails, would you buy that product or would you buy a competitor? Marital integrity, absolute commitment to the permanence of marriage. A principle is be a virgin and seek a virgin. No pornography or illicit sexual actions. And then soul, what's the personality like? Why marry a person that has a personality that you're not attracted to? Common interests will build automatic bridges between you. And don't marry your mission. You know, it's great if someone improves because of your interaction with them, but don't choose an immature person for marriage. I know an older single lady who wanted marriage, and she said no to a suitor when she realized that in marriage her main job would be helping him in his deficiencies. And after she said no, an ideal young man came along. You see, don't marry your mission. And then, of course, body is reserved for marriage. Avoid all sensual stimulation that is not godly. Now, maybe you think this standard that we've talked about this weekend is too high. You know, sometimes when I preach about what the Bible actually says, people think, well, that's just unreasonable to expect all of that. And so I'm going to, again, invite Rhoda to come up and read for us. Because I want you to hear that God's standard is not too high, and how in Nigeria, God gave supernatural, amazing strength and fortitude and courage to absolutely baby Christians. This is a newsletter that Rochelle wrote to us in the spring of 2004.
One day, a believer we'll call Adam heard that his mother was missing. He was dismayed at this and began an inquiry. Evidently, she had remonstrated with her husband about his rejection of their son, Adam, for being a believer. The husband had exploded and accused her of aiding their son in becoming a heathen. At that time, she said, "I'm not going to follow this religion anymore either. I know that Jesus is the Savior." His father beat her up, and now she was no longer at their camp. He happened to bump into a friend of his from school and learned that she was in the friend's home village. This village is radically anti-Christian. Christians are not allowed to live there, and they boast that no Christian has ever preached there. The friend said that she was confined at a religious leader's house. Adam's stomach lurched when he heard that. He set out for the village right away. Twice he was attacked in that village by people who wanted to rid the world of a heathen. Both times God intervened to save his life. But when he finally arrived and saw his mother, tears came to his eyes. She was severely beaten with livid stripes on her back and sides. When she saw him, she began to cry and beg him to go away before the same thing happened to him. But he couldn't just go away and leave her like that. Two of his sisters were sitting there, and he sat down too and tried to talk to her. She had not been given any food since coming, and she was not even allowed to bathe. Adam gave his sister some money and told her to go buy some food right away. The sister came back with the food, but just as she was bringing it, the religious leader grabbed it and spilled it all over the floor. All day and all night, Adam sat with his mother. She couldn't lie down. She was too sore. He begged her to run away with him, although he himself couldn't imagine how he could get her out. But she refused. "What is left for me?" she said. "My husband has beaten me up. My own children and grandchildren have beaten me and jeered at me. If they let me out of here, I will go home. What more can they do? If they kill me, it will be a relief. I just want to know one thing. Does Jesus have any promise for those who are suffering because of him?" He could hardly speak. "Jesus says that he will never leave you," he said thickly. His mother nodded. "That is enough for me," she said. "Now, I want you to leave this place." In the morning, the religious leader and his colleagues came in to give her her usual breakfast. water containing a magic potion intended to bring her to her senses. She refused to drink, and they pinned her arms behind her back, forced her mouth open, and poured the water in, slapping her and insulting her for becoming a heathen. She started crying again. "Get away from here now," she said to Adam. "There is nothing you can do. You're having a good life where you are. Get away while you still can." Finally, at her frantic urging, he left. Several days later, someone brought him news of his mother. Although she still had been given nothing to eat, she didn't seem hungry at all, and she was singing. The religious leaders were saying that demons came and would feed her at night. Adam couldn't rest, though, and soon he and a friend went back there together to visit and encourage her. The religious leader was now allowing people to feed her if they wanted to, so Adam's sister was feeding her. After spending 2 days with her, Adam and his friend left. By the grace of God, nobody questioned or hindered them. The news of this woman's stand for Christ has reached every person in an area that prides itself on never having had the gospel preached there. That in itself is a mighty accomplishment. She stood firm, clinging to the two verses that her son has taught her. Jesus' promise, "I will never leave you or forsake you," and "there is now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus." To a woman emerging from the never-relenting uncertainty and condemnation of a grim and burdensome belief system, Christ's canceling her condemnation was freedom beyond imagining. And so what if she was confined in a nasty little room? And if they beat her and starved her and force-fed her magic potions? She knew she was free at last. Physically, she was in terrible shape. Her wounds, untreated, became ugly and infected. Once she was beaten to the point that she swooned for about an hour and a half. She came to and found her two daughters bending over her and crying. They thought she was dead. "Don't cry for me," she said to them. "Do you know what I've just seen? I've seen the place I'm going. It is so lovely I can't describe it. I didn't want to come back here. Don't cry for me. Cry for yourselves. Cry for these people all around us, because they're not going there." She said to her son while he was there, "Don't you dare ever turn back from following Christ. You see what I've gone through for following him? He is worth it. Don't you ever, ever turn back." And then this is an update from August 2004. Later, the mother was telling her two daughters how grieved she was for them. She had seen the marvelous place where she was going when she died, but she knew that they would go to a terrible place because they didn't know Jesus. They said, "We have been watching you and listening to you, and we want to follow Jesus too. What should we do to become his followers?" The mother said, "Well, I think you should tell him you want to follow him. I don't know very much about praying yet, but why don't you just say this, 'Oh, Jesus, thank you for loving me. I want you to enter my heart. Help me to follow you. In the sufferings that I will have for following you, help me. In the beatings that I will get for following you, help me. Thank you. Amen.'" The sisters prayed as their mother instructed them, and she was so happy that she got up and danced around the little room. "Now two more of my children have come to Jesus," she kept saying. Of course, the news was all over the area in no time. The sisters' husbands came and beat them up and told them never to come home. When Adam got there, their heads were all swollen up from where their husbands had beaten them. And yet all three of the women were just spilling over with joy. They said that every day as they were being beaten, Jesus filled them with such wonderful joy that they didn't mind the blows. They were not supposed to receive any food, but there was a woman who sympathized with them. She would come to visit every evening and managed to sneak food in daily. Adam left money with her to keep on buying food. One evening, the wife of the religious leader, keeping the women locked up, came to talk to the mother. She had heard from her husband about the time they beat the mother senseless and how they thought she was dead until she came to more than an hour later, telling strange stories about the glorious place she had seen and how she had begged them to just kill her then and there so she could go back. "What did you see?" the religious leader's wife asked. "What place did you go to?" "I don't know where it was," said the mother, "but I know it is God's place, and I am going there when I die." "But what was it like?" "I can't describe it. It was so wonderful, I couldn't even grasp it all, let alone explain it to someone else. But if you had seen it, you wouldn't care about this world anymore either." The religious leader's wife asked lots of questions and finally retired for the night, deep in thought. The next morning, she came to visit again. Soon her husband came in to force-feed the three women the magic water, and when they resisted, he started slapping them around and insulting them. His wife begged him to desist. He looked at her as if she was out of her mind and then continued. She begged him again to stop. He ignored her pleas. Finally, she said, "If you're going to treat them that way, you might as well do it to me too. I have realized that Jesus is the only Savior, and I am following him from now on." Her husband turned, thunderstruck. Then he hurried out of the room in deepest mourning. His own wife! A number of men soon showed up to punish this new outrage. They flung the woman into the mud and beat her until her clothes were in shreds. They also beat up the other three for deceiving her. Then they locked them all in together, and the four of them had time to fellowship and praise Jesus undisturbed. The mother was very concerned about this woman. "You know they are going to kill you," she said. "A religious leader could not let a disgrace like this rest on his home. You need to escape. But where?" Eventually, they decided that she should escape to another city. But of course, she had no money for transportation. Soon the woman who daily provided them with food came to visit. At the mother's request, she went and got the food money Adam had left with her and gave it to the religious leader's wife for transport. Their plan was simple, and their jailers obviously inexperienced. The visiting woman went to the door and said she was ready to go. The guard let her out, and then the religious leader's wife said she needed to go out to use the bathroom. So they let her out too, and she never came back from the bathroom. Great was the consternation the next day when it was realized that the religious leader's wife was gone. They severely beat the three who were left for aiding her, but the bird had flown. The next time Adam went up to see his mother, she was lying on the floor and moaning in pain, and she was alone. The religious leaders had decided to separate the three women. They had come in and hauled the two sisters away, each to a different place. "Whatever they do to you, don't deny Jesus," the mother called after them as they were hauled out the door. "Even if they kill you, don't deny Jesus." The two sisters were each taken to the houses of different religious leaders in two different towns, no doubt with the idea that separating everyone might make them more willing to recant. However, as God would have it, this forcibly spread the gospel to other towns. As the townspeople came pouring in to see the famous heretics, reproach them, and attempt to reconvert them, they heard the good news. One of the sisters was physically in serious condition. Shortly before their separation, she was beaten so severely that she lost the sight in one of her eyes. She was taken to the custody of a female religious leader who intended to begin her cure by a long interrogation, a formidable list of questions all written out. "Why are you putting yourself to all this hardship?" "Let me tell you the truth," said the sister. "Do you see how my whole body is bruised and swollen and injured?" "Yes." "Well, I feel so good right now that I can't even describe it." The interrogator looked at her oddly and continued with the next question. "You are a one-eyed woman now. Why would you give up the sight of one of your eyes for this worthless pagan named Jesus?" "I would gladly give up the sight of both my eyes for him," answered the sister. And where I am going, I will have my sight back, better sight than I have ever had before. Her interrogator pushed on. Do you understand that you will probably be executed? And do you realize that what you have suffered so far is small compared to what is being planned for you? The sister answered steadily, looking up with her one good eye, the other one swollen shut and still draining blood. It doesn't matter what anyone does to me now, because I have learned to forgive. Now, when someone hits me, it doesn't sit on my heart and make me angry and unhappy. A minute later, I've already forgotten who did it. So it doesn't matter what they do. And if they kill me, I know where I am going. My mother has been there and seen the place, and I can't wait. At this, her interrogator burst into tears, tore up the sheet of questions, and left the room. After that, the sister was treated with much more kindness. She was even given a mattress, so for the first time in weeks, she didn't have to sleep on the floor. And her jailer began shielding her from those who wanted to come browbeat and punish her. Later, pressure on the mother was stepped up. There was a big rally in the town where she was being held, and hundreds of zealots came to reproach her for becoming a heathen. They dipped her hand in boiling water and removed all the skin, then poured boiling water down her back and removed more skin. Then they broke both bones in the forearm of the burned hand. But as each person passed by to insult her, she would hold up her flopping, burned arm and say, "See this? Jesus has healed it. I feel no pain. And let me tell you something. Jesus is the only way to be saved. You are following the wrong path." Best of all, one fellow from another city came to the meeting, and when he had a private moment with the mother, he whispered, "I am from the city where the religious leader's wife fled. She arrived safely and is well. It is because of her testimony that I too now follow Jesus. She says to stand strong and be encouraged." At last, the mother was released into the custody of sympathetic relatives, where she could be well taken care of. One sister was killed. An angry zealot stabbed her with a knife. But before her death, she led 12 of the women of that town to Christ. And those have begun leading others to him too. When the mother received news of her daughter's death, she called for a bull to be slaughtered and a feast to be prepared. Adam arrived and was flabbergasted to see everyone celebrating. But why not? Their sister had gone where she longed to be. She was safe at last.